Report testing, let's see what happens now.
Why this thing didn't start to record earlier.
Could you tell us where you were born?
Yes, right here in Pine Township.
Pine Township. Whereabouts in Pine Township? Is that in the town of Grove City?
In the town of Grove City, about 2 miles out, which is now, well, I think it was Enterprise in that area.
Out towards London, is it?
My nephew, Clifford Bowden, was, we were both born in the same house.
Oh, is that right?
Out this way. Pine, the Pine Township extension, out that way.
Oh, I see. Let's see. Were your parents born in this country?
Yes. No, my father was not. My father was born in Sweden.
Oh.
And came to this country when he was 12 years of age.
I see. Did he remember Sweden?
Possibly, but he died when I was...
Oh, I see, yes. He died when you were young.
And I didn't hear anything about Sweden.
I see. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I'm the last of eight.
Eight.
Four girls and four boys in the family.
How did your family live after your father died?
Well, they sold the little house out here in the country, and then they moved to Akron, Ohio. He had a heart attack, at which time they bought a restaurant. And they knew nothing about restaurant business, but they bought one.
What kind of restaurant was it? Do you remember that?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember
Akron?
A lot
of people coming in and out. Uh-huh. Oh, yes. On 16 Barges Street it was.
Uh-huh. Was it a happy life?
It was a lovely, wonderful uh-huh. time. Yes, my childhood was that way. I was, I had, he would sit at the cashier's desk and sell cigars and tobacco uh-huh. and everything. And being the youngest, I would be put up on the table to recite Hiawatha and different things, you know.
Oh, is that right?
I enjoyed at the time uh-huh. very much. So,
was it a family kind of restaurant?
It was a family restaurant. Uh-huh. And they seemed to make a go of it. Then my father uh-huh. died when I was 4 and a half. And I remember he was taken care of. And it looked to me like, as I remember, it was a sunroom with a lot of geraniums and things around, and it was private yeah. from the other apartment upstairs. We lived up over it. And the older children, some were married, you see, because I was born, my older sister was 20, I was born on her 23rd birthday.
I see.
So it was shock, I suppose, that might have killed him, having
yeah.
a child so late in life. But and I understand either they are morons or extra bright and so mm-hmm. you know, or something, you know, people
yeah.
it hasn't been proven exactly
yeah.
no. So
well, what was it like in the restaurant? What was the most popular food sold there?
To me, food meant nothing. They had a hard time getting me to eat.
Oh, is that
and
right?
I had a running charge at the little soda fountain across around the corner
uh-huh.
where I could go and sit down and always get ice cream, and they'd say give her any ice cream she wants. And I could also go to the bakery wagon to eat that, yes, because to me it didn't mean a thing,
uh-huh.
food. I don't even remember anything except they had uh-huh. tables all around with the cane back chairs and the water cooler, which I tipped over one time. And then I remember when the nieces and nephews visited, I treated them to chewing tobacco, which I had never chewed, but I uh-huh. told them I had. And I had always wanted to try it.
Uh-huh.
But, yes, it was very nice. And all I can remember was a real nice time.
Mm-hmm. How are restaurants different today than they were then?
Well, the comparison would be hard for me to make because, as I say, I was so young that I don't remember anything. But I know there was quite a lot of racket in the kitchen.
Oh, is that right?
Over once in a while, the cook who was brought in would sometimes take off with a skillet and, you know, and
get mad,
real mad, uh-huh.
At who? One of his helpers?
Oh, well, yeah, something like that. And
they would actually get into fights?
Yes, real fights.
What would they fight about?
Gee, I don't know, but you know too many cooks spoil a broth.
It was something
you know,
like that.
Actually,
yeah.
uh-huh. that might have been an ego thing,
could've
I don't
been,
know.
Yeah.
But that wasn't... Then after my father died, there was the problem of getting reestablished, more or less. So we moved into a brand new house out in Akron, out in Park Avenue, which was, we didn't know anything about a night lock. I remember getting in that night. Mother had to, we wondered what happened because we'd locked ourselves out. Things like that. And then I went to school there up until I was about 12.
Your mother didn't understand a lock?
A night lock. No, none of us did. You see, I had older brothers and sisters there, and I remember the way that they lived was, in those times, the only thing women did for a living would be to sew or to have roomers and boarders.
Yeah.
You see.
Must have been pretty hard for her, huh?
It was a very difficult life. Yeah. She was of German descent, Schaefer, and she was a hardy woman. But yes, it was, I remember.
A woman all alone in a city.
All alone with children and not knowing what to do. And the boys, it was always difficult. I'd hear, well, they can't get work. They're not employing now. They had the rubber works.
Oh, yeah.
But they were not employed as...
They couldn't get jobs.
Well, no. Quite often they couldn't. And there was no relief. You wouldn't even think of it.
Yeah.
But through one way or the other, the mother had the backbone, and she brought them up, you know, in her own, without telling anybody. But you sensed it.
Uh-huh.
You sensed it.
Your mother was strong enough to keep you secure. Huh?
Yes. Until she married then, when I was 10 years of age and came back into this area. And that, of course, broke my heart, because when my father died, I kept saying to her, I'm going to meet my dad, my papa, in heaven very soon. You know, I had these great imagines, and I thought I really was. And that made her feel real happy, I suppose, you know. I was preparing to die or something.
Yeah.
However, she married again, and then... In the meantime, she married a barber out here, George Barber. They had the farm where the Kring bought, and that was an old English type of home.
An English style.
It was a nice old home, and they had the carriage shed and the horses. And
where was that located?
Right out Pine Township, the very same place. It's where Mr. Kring, do you not know Mr. Kring from the Grove City College?
No.
Well, he lives there. And so long and after they, you know, he was a prosperous farmer and an old English type fellow, but he had a large family. And it wasn't until the older boy discovered coal and all kinds of mineral on this farm. But the older people had died. My mother then had died.
Mm-hmm.
And he had died, too.
Mm-hmm.
And there they found just all kinds of wealth on that farm, which they didn't, of course, recognize. And there was coal and all this. But then he, too, died without realizing or benefiting too much from it. And his wife lived, quite a character. She lived, and she, too, didn't know what to do with it because... I don't ever know what happened to that. However, that was not any of our side of the family.
Oh, I see.
And then, in the meantime, I lived, more or less as I grew up, I lived with a brother-in-law who was his father and mother and so on. His family were all ministers, Methodist ministers.
Uh-huh.
And they raised me most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Who was this now? You lived with a brother-in-law?
Yes, a brother-in-law. Rich.
Married to your sister.
Mm-hmm. One of my sisters, and they had a jewelry store here in Grove City.
Oh, here in town.
The Rich Jewelry Company years ago.
The Rich Jewelry
Company.
Uh-huh.
And then he went to Columbia University after he graduated from Grove City and went to Columbia to become an optometrist along with the jewelry business. But then in the meantime, here's the part of my life that is sad to relate. I always had nice, good... Then you're more class conscious.
Yeah.
You were told always choose your company.
Yeah. Right.
So we did, and somehow I fit into it.
Uh-huh.
And I was with a nice group, and but I married too young.
Yeah.
I married at the age of 17. Immediately after, I was pregnant. 11 months I had a child, and then again another year. So,
very close after being married, huh?
Yes. Well, 11 months, yeah. You see. And, well, it was difficult for both of us. And we had nothing, the rapport was very bad because, and I liked his sisters, I still do, and so on. So after that culminated in divorce, which then was a very bad thing to have happen.
Well, was it? Is it different from today? Was it hard on you?
Well, I suppose, yes, it was. Mm-hmm. And so I went back
to
school.
Did people say things, or were they
no,
mean to you?
No, but you just knew that it wasn't. You just knew.
Wasn't done.
And here was a thing. You would go to church, and the first thing, the minister would say, have everybody come to church, even long after, in years later, then you'd no sooner get all settled, and they'd start about how you were going to hell. If you were married, you know, if you didn't cleave to your husband,
I see.
Well, that gave everyone a guilty complex right there.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was a child of this marriage, which made it. There was also one that died before, you see, with meningitis, supposedly.
What year did you get divorced?
About 28, I believe, yes.
Was it mostly the church that gave you difficulty about the divorce?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so because I always was accepted with people because I don't push myself. Yeah. And I'm not an outgoing person and telling my personal problems or relating to anybody, which is probably bad. Because as I've learned since by being a resident director in a college, I know that how the kids would come in and what I had was nothing compared to what a lot of them had.
Yeah.
So, well, at any rate, this went on, and then the custody of the child and fighting and this, that, and the other. Well, I was an orphan. And the person to whom I was married was pretty well fixed and influential in this town because of his affiliation with the Bessemer and so on. Well, that is the part that I don't wish to go into any farther, which has always been a very sad thing, and I was advised by both my one brother-in-law was a pharmacist, another brother-in-law was a very gentle, nice man, both of them, and they said, you can't crucify yourself the rest of your life.
Yeah.
You can't keep pulling the boy back and forth.
Yeah.
He must be one place or the other. Suppose you had an illegitimate child, which you didn't, and had given him up, then you would really... so this way, it will be for the good of the child rather than... And then in the meantime, I had to work because it was a depression. There was no way possible that I could...
That was difficult.
You see, yes. So what I did, I went back to school and I worked and then I got... I had business in college or in the high school.
Uh-huh.
So you never forget typing and shorthand, ish hand, you know. So that enabled me to find employment with an insurance company.
Here in town?
No, I lived in Pittsburgh.
I
went to Pittsburgh because I had an older sister there.
Oh, I see.
And lived with them. Well, then in the meantime, I went back to school and I graduated from Duff's Business College. I then went to, I met my second husband who was the attorney on the case. In the divorce case, and he was a lot older, but he was a nice, kind person, and I had regular meals, which I didn't have when I was first married. Everything went to a good time, and no work, and sleeping till noon, you know, this is his pattern, and then that's all right if you happen to be a profession that needs you to get up at noon, you know. Well, so at any rate, then I had a beautiful big home. I had everything to offer, even to my son, who then was established more or less in his own pattern, and you couldn't blame him. So, consequently then, of course, again, I had a child. I was married in 37, and I had Nancy in, I was married in 36 and had her in 37. And she has been a great joy to me because, and she now teaches school in Jersey, is married and has three children. And in the meantime, what I did then after the second husband died, when she was only 13, and we still lived in Pittsburgh, I, through the church and through, you might say, political affiliation, Because he, being an attorney, I got a job first with the an insurance company, and then again with the Comstock agency. Then I got one with juvenile court, where I worked for 5 years in Pittsburgh with juvenile court. And until Nancy married, she went to college, and I taught her shorthand, and right along we worked together, along with her academic course. And she married a young chap from the law school, who since has died. He had multiple sclerosis. And they moved to New Jersey, where she's living now, and remarried, and has two children to her second husband. And her first child, she thought she couldn't have any. She had adopted a little boy when he was 5 days old, and we all love him dearly, and he was an illegitimate child. But then I, after she married, and I was heartbroken because I was alone in my apartment.
Oh, in Pittsburgh?
So, yes. Uh-huh. So she was with a sorority, and she said, "Mother, why don't you become a house mother?" So I went to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I stored my furniture and went down there, and it was at the time that Lucy was not accepted. She was the first Negress taken in.
Oh, yes.
And what a delightful time I had, and it looked like the dean, they were always going to burn both of us in effigy. She was Dean Patey, and I was Mrs. Dipple.
You were involved in that, huh?
Yes,
oh,
and you see, and
I
went to all these things and got in the wrong toilets and did everything wrong. Got on the wrong taxi, and he said, "Lady, you're from the north." And he said, "Let me tell you something. If we see you calivanting around with any niggers, we're just not going. You know what's going to happen to you." Well, I was just so dumb that I loved the kids, you know. And I had to have this sorority house, which was a Jewish sorority. I had to provide a meal, 3 meals a day for a girl, for each child, and buy the food, you know. And of course, you had maid service, and you had to supervise the servants.
Big job.
And all this. Then I went from that. They said, "Oh, good Lord, you can type. My Lord, we didn't know that." So then you got your own fraternity house. Then you got to be a resident director. Then I went to school down in Lexington, Kentucky, and I got to be a director of residences. I came back to New York, New Paltz, New York, where I was...
Another life, huh?
Yes, and there they said you need a college degree, and the dean said you do like HEL. Oh, excuse me. He said you do not need that. You've had enough experience that we would rather have you as you are, and you can handle help. You can handle the office force and everything. So that was quite a thing.
Yeah.
Then, after all that, then I moved back to, I was then 62, and I retired. And came back here and bought a little duplex. And I had the students upstairs, prospective ministers. And from then on, I paid my house off in half the time.
Is that right?
And didn't have many stakes, didn't eat much, you know, in the way of goodies.
Yeah,
paid it off, and I worked hard all my life.
You've had quite a life.
Every penny. Yes, and I have always been very short-sighted in my vision, I mean to say. I've been very, very... that I had to compensate in other ways. I also took vocal lessons when I was in Pittsburgh, and I loved that. I love the theater, I love music, and all that, and so that's my sordid life.
That's very interesting.
Well, I suppose.
Can you tell me about that civil rights problem down there?
Oh, yes.
Well, did you meet, what was her name? Lucy, her last name was Lucy, wasn't it?
Lucy. I didn't meet her, no.
Uh-huh.
I didn't, because I wasn't aware of all this, how involved I had gotten into it, really.
Oh, where was Tuscaloosa, University
Tuscaloosa,
of Alabama.
Tuscaloosa, the playground of the South, where they, they would throw their champagne glasses on the floor and walk in it, and the kids had to get acquainted, to get accustomed to drinking, the whole nail liquor.
Oh, is that right?
And it was really a sporty school, you know, in that respect. It was... It was just the way of the South.
Yeah.
They had to.
Yeah. Well, what happened?
You wore your white gloves to the tees and perspired. And well, what happened in that respect?
What were your impressions of the problem with that colored girl, Miss Lucy? What was your first exposure to the problem?
Well, my exposure was this. I went to then they were trying to bring in as many of the personnel as they could from the north.
Why?
To try to even it up so that they would soften the blow, I think, of bringing in the colored people.
Oh, I see.
And don't you see in these sororities...
The college tried to do that, huh?
Well,
or
yes.
Was it the college?
Well, I don't know. You see, they had the Ku Klux Klan there, too. And, of course, I didn't have anything to do. I said, you mean to tell me you still have that going around? I didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
But here, yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yes. Uh-huh. But here was my experience, you see. Here I am. I came in, and I looked very young then. They didn't expect me to be. I tried to tell them I was my true age, but I think most of the people were. Well, I don't know. At any rate, that doesn't have so much to do with it, except it was really green and looking back. And they had, for instance, they put on show plays of the dean being hobnobbing with the Negroes and kissing them, and come in for tea, darling. Oh, do come. And won't you come over for dinner Sunday night? You know, bring your pickaninnies with you and all this. You know, things that were very degrading to the dean of women, if she had permitted it. But she was of the school where she realized the potential there maybe of what it was for, and she just accepted it. She knew that this was probably her niche in life. She had selected that as her college. Uh-huh. Although she was like I was, she didn't really realize what she's getting into. Uh-huh. And then...
Was she a northerner?
A northerner, uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And she tried to get along with the blacks, or...?
Oh, yes. She
so
was
they made
for
fun
them.
Of her, huh?
So they did, yes. They burned her in effigy.
Is that right?
They did everything, uh-huh. Yes.
Did they make life difficult for her?
I don't know. I don't know her personal life that way. I have no idea, but she just kind of laughed it off.
Uh-huh.
And with me, what they said one day, I went in to get stamps, and he said, "Are you, whose picture would you like on that stamp? Would you like Lincoln?" And of course, I said, "Why, certainly." He said, "I thought so." Then, in coming from town, Birmingham, I rode on the bus with a negress, who was there for whatever purpose. I didn't know it, and she turned around and spoke to me. And started to talk about something, and naturally, it didn't mean a thing to me.
Yeah.
So I spoke with her, and so that Thanksgiving, which was about a week away, one of the directors came over, and she said, "Hazel, darling, you hurry, quick, get your suitcase together, get out of that dormitory," because she said, "I'm telling you, I don't know what's going to happen. Come right over," and I went over and with her,
uh-huh.
And she said, "Now, you see that gun on the table? Well, I have it loaded. And anything that happens, I'll use it." And I said, "Well, gee, I hope you're not going to use it on me. What's the problem?"
Yeah.
Just things like that, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then going into the Birmingham, I'd go into the station to wait for a bus. And this time, a negress sat down beside me, a young girl. And she said, she looked up and rolled her eyes. And an old fella came over, a white man with a cane. And he held it up over... shook it, just he was so filled with rage. He said to me, "Were you sitting there first, or was she sitting there?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" "I don't know." I said, "I never noticed her there." He said, "Well," he went over to her and he took this cane over her and he said, "You get your black," and he swore at her, "up off that seat and out of here." And he said, "I'll kill you. You hear? I'll kill you dead if I ever see you in here again." Now, that was the worst I've ever seen.
Was that before the sit-ins? Was that when blacks were demanding the right to sit where whites sat?
Oh, that came a little later. That same, because I remember, now then, at the same time, the next year, they had, when Kennedy was in, they said, "Well, Mr. Kennedy, our sorority house, that they were given their equal rights."
Yeah.
This one girl came in, she said, "Miss Dibble, I don't know what I'm going to do. My daddy's just going to kill me if he knows those niggers are sitting on our toilets. And they're also, those maids are drinking out of the water fountain." I said, "Well, I presume you're going to have to take your problems to Mr. Kennedy, because I have nothing to do with that. And I imagine those women have been using and cleaning your toilets and drinking out of your faucet for a heck of a long time."
Right. Well,
then I was over a New Pulse then. Oh, yes, that was real. That alone would make a wonderful...
That's quite a story.
Yeah, it really is. And I had got off the bus first to come in, and I hailed a colored taxi, and that was when he told me that I'd better not ride with any Negroes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Boy, there must have been a lot
of tension. It really was, and I went the day that they turned the bus over in Birmingham and came back, and they said, did you know what happened? No, I said, I didn't. What happened? Well, I was right there, and I didn't see it. So they said, how do you feel about the colored people? Someone asked me once, and I said, well, to tell you the truth, I'm scared of them. I had a nigger man chase me when I was 12 years old in Akron.
Oh, is that right?
And I said, he just was going to get me for sure. He really did. And we had a picket fence around the house, and my brother, long-legged, jumped over it. And if he had gotten a hold of him, he wouldn't have been, he wouldn't have treated him.
What was he chasing
nice.
You for? Had you?
I have no idea. I went down to the store. It was just dusk. I don't know what he was doing, but he sure...
Were there many blacks living
but
in Akron?
That frightened me, you see.
Yeah,
I didn't see any. That was the only one. Not where we lived. I didn't see any.
Well, that was an historic time to be living in Alabama, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was,
uh-huh. You mentioned that you worked, what was it, in the juvenile court, did you say?
In the Pittsburgh.
Yeah, what was that like?
Well,
how did they treat kids in those days in juvenile
court? Well, don't you
court?
See, I had nothing to do with the children. I wasn't a probation officer. What I did was, first I started in the pool, in the typing pool.
Yeah.
And there you had these cases. You had a dictaphone to your ear, and I had never used one. But I knew my spelling and punctuation and all that, that it had to be presented then to the judge.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe what I heard. And I said, you know, all horrible. They just write out and said all these things.
Mm-hmm. What had happened to the kids?
Oh, everybody, and the children, and the group cases of where, and how they were forgiven over and over. Then finally, after a year, I said, I cannot take this. It's making me very morbid. Nancy used to say, Mother, I wish you had never gone to juvenile court.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So
it really got to you.
It really did. So then I asked to be exchanged, and she said, I was wondering, my supervisor was a Jewish woman. I was wondering how long you were going to sit there and take that. She said, we're going to put you in bookkeeping. Down to another, so Judge Schramm came in and walked back to my desk, and he says, Mrs. Dipple, do you like your position? And I was scared to death of the head lady who was about to retire, but she wouldn't allow you to open your window or anything. You know, she was the boss at that time. And I said, oh, yes, very much. He said, well, if you have any problems, be sure to see me. And he bowed, and of course, that was my entree to that little corner at which I held.
Uh-huh.
And then I did I set up the appointments for the children and the transfers, the court orders, placing them in the different homes. And their clothing appointments or dental appointments and everything had to be coincide with that. I did the menu. They fed the children upstairs. I took care of every detail in and out.
Oh,
and
the kids lived there.
Tabulating, yes, some of them upstairs.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Were they much of a problem? You know?
Oh.
In
it was degrading for the children, I think, to be sent there, in my opinion.
Are they still
They
sent to
learned
them?
So much that they shouldn't have. Because
from
was,
each other?
Yes, there was an awful lot of degeneracy.
Yeah.
Which, and the little boys would, you wouldn't think a little boy would be subject to that, but he was, you see.
Yeah.
You learned all the things you never heard about.
Right. Did the state take pretty good care of those kids in those days or not?
Oh, they got
was
all...
Was it the county or the state?
The county. That was the county.
I see.
They got, it was in Oakland, in Pittsburgh. They got all their clothing, all their dental work, their doctor bills, everything. But they were transferred so frequently, one to the other home, because they couldn't adjust. Well, who could?
Yeah.
You see, who could?
Yeah.
And while I had trouble with my childhood and having my marriage break up and my child and all that, still, I've been with children so that I compensated for anything.
Yeah. It just slipped my mind. Did you think the county tried to do a good job of the kids, or was it just perfunctory, the treatment of the kids?
Well, as I say, my personal contact with the children was nil.
Uh-huh.
I was in the department where they collected money, trying to get money from the fathers who would not pay and would run away. You see, I was in that bookkeeping department, and where they took track of all of the food and all of the clothing and in that particular department.
Yeah.
So that really, the only thing that I had was my first initiation into listening to all these, which was the way to go, because you wouldn't appreciate it if you didn't hear. You couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
You could not believe it. No, they're very, it was a very morbid, what goes on in the world is really horrible.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I know the one man there, this is, why? Anyway.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know, I mean, even, oh my, it's not good.
No. It hasn't gotten any better either, has it?
No, I was scared to death of this one. I mean, he was a supervisor, and I'm telling you, you know, but I mean.
What was he like?
Well, he would just sort of suggest, you know, you'd have to sit there and listen to all this stuff, and then he'd kind of make sly remarks. He didn't say anything, but you know, when you weren't, at that time, you weren't accustomed to that. It sort of would go against your grain. But Judge Schramm was a nice dandy. He was born with a silver spoon, and he was a real nice
gentleman,
but I don't think he knew the score.
Oh, is that right?
I mean, I think that he was always forgiving, and I think that he...
To the kids, you mean?
Oh, I think he was very sympathetic and very kind, and all the probation officers were probation. They were real... They tried, I'm quite sure. But
he was too soft, you think?
I think when we... Once you do a thing, twice, all right, but the third time, you see, I mean, it gets to be. And I think the juvenile court, by turning it over to a public institution to take care of, I don't believe, and paying the people to go out and have more children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this woman came in, she'd had 9 illegitimate children.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept telling her he didn't want